Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Because he loved flying, retired dentist Mike Paul was able to collect aviation-based stories, which he published in his first book, Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe. He then wrote three flight mystery books, followed by a three-volume spy thriller series. Mike Paul used his professional experience as a dentist in the San Francisco Bay Area to create the character in his latest book, The Mouth Mechanic. This dentist tells his story in the first person and lives in San Francisco. Dr. Paul now lives in Chico. Mike Paul, welcome.
Thank you, thank you.
Well, now, this book is entitled The Mouth Mechanic.
The Mouth Mechanic.
Was that your idea?
It was my idea, and that was all my idea.
Well, there is a sense of humor that comes through the book, which I enjoyed, and I'm sure readers will enjoy that. But what gave you the idea to write about what in this person's occupation now is a forensic odontologist? And what gave you that idea?
Well, as you said, I am a dentist, so it's nice to write about somewhere that you come from. That my last series was a spy mystery series, and I have no connection whatsoever with it. And, the rule of thumb is write what you know, but the last series, I had to research everything to figure out how the story would proceed. In this book, because a dentist is the protagonist, I've got some knowledge and I can speak as if I'm the character. I'm not the character, by the way. I have some good friends who say, oh, this is about you. I say, no, it's not about me. And there are some idiosyncrasies of my main character that I'm happy it's not about me.
Well, do you know, I have fairly recently discovered a series called Forensic Files, and I've been watching those. So I thought maybe you recognize the popularity of forensic science in solving mysteries that go back maybe 10, 20 years that people were not able to solve them then. But I also think most people understand that when a body is found, often the only way of tracking down who this person was through their dental records.
And the Forensic Files was a TV series, mm-hmm. right? Well, there's also been novels like Kathy Reich's Bones series. Bones was also a TV. And Patricia Cornwell, she also has a character that she writes about. And they're forensic medical doctors. And that's what they usually are. This is the first time I've ever seen the dentist, who does play a part in these forensics and identifying dead bodies. But it's the first time I've seen anybody write about them. So that's why I chose him.
Well, let's meet this forensic
dentist.
All righty,
let's meet him.
Let's start with your opening paragraphs.
Okay, let me read here. If it's true that good luck is the result of good planning, then it stands to reason that dumb luck is the result of not planning at all. I never planned to end up where I did, call it fate or destiny or even karma, but the confluence of pushy parents, an addiction to alcohol, and the state of California professional code created the perfect storm that led me to a dissection table in the basement of the San Francisco morgue. I was raised in Brooklyn, New York, where if you were Jewish and not named Neil Diamond or Jerry Seinfeld, your parents pushed you hard to become a doctor. I did some quick calculation of the number of years it would take and decided the idea didn't appeal to me. Instead, I negotiated with my dad, and after hours of haggling, we agreed that I would go for a dental degree. It was close enough for him. Dentists wore white coats, and people called them doctor. It wasn't until 4 years later, after I was accepted to UCLA Dental School, that my father realized it was going to cost him $250,000. All of a sudden, he began to picture me as a successful plumber or electrician. But it was too late. In July 2008, I packed my bags and headed for Los Angeles. Coming from the New York area, I never felt comfortable in L.A. Maybe it was the absence of snow in the winter, or the smog in the summer, or maybe it was all the plastic surgery survivors who roamed the streets. But after graduation, I couldn't wait to get out of there. I moved north and opened a practice in Marin County, an upscale community just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. When I had the sign made for my new office, the shingle was too small to fit my name, so I changed it. My name, that is. I went from Richard Roshankovsky to Rick Rose. It was a twofer. It fit perfectly on the sign, and for the first time in my life, people would be able to pronounce it.
This is Chico author Mike Paul reading from a Rick Rose novel, The Mouth Mechanic. And now we know where the name, it's a Rick Rose novel, because he tells us he had to shorten that long name he had. And the listeners can't see, I was smiling as you were reading that, because your humor comes out in a lot of your pages. So let's pick up a little bit more and find out what this dentist does.
Well, he goes into practice, as we said, in Marin County, and everything is going well. He has a little issue. He gets married and has a little issue with his wife. They're happily married, but they can't seem to have children, and this bothers his wife a lot, to the point that after about 4 or 5 years, she inherits some money from her grandmother, buys a condo in the next neighboring city, and takes the cat and leaves. And so Rick is left all by himself. He doesn't handle it very well. He starts to drink a little more than usual, and when one of his assistants at work smells alcohol in his breath at 10 o'clock, then, as I say, the fall came quickly, and he loses his license.
He loses his license, he loses his patience, he loses his cat.
He did lose his cat. And he has to go to what's called a diversion program, and that's...
They don't call it AA because he's a white coat guy.
That's right. I say it's kind of an AA for people with white coats and latex gloves.
Well, let's pick up where he found a place to live.
Yeah, so after he gets out of, he gets his license back, but he has no practice, so he doesn't know what to do. And he says, a buddy of mine offered me an apartment in a building he owned in the upscale Pacific Heights neighborhood of the city. I jumped at it. I sold my house, moved to San Francisco, and began living off the equity while I tried to figure out how to put my life back together. After 2 months of frustration, I was sorting through the junk mail when I spotted a professional flyer from the city and county of San Francisco. They were looking for a forensic odontologist. I had only a vague idea of what that was, but the ad stated a dental license was required, and the starting salary was $136,400. How bad could it be? I Googled the job title and found forensic odontologists were dentists who helped in criminal investigations, especially in cases where nobody could identify who the dead guy was. I filled out an application along with my curriculum vitae, a fancy name for a resume, which I beefed up with my short list of accomplishments. I thought it best to leave off my 2019 graduation from the alcohol diversion program. Apparently, the offbeat idea of working on dead patients didn't appeal to many dentists. I'm pretty sure I was the only applicant. The county paid for a 3-month course, after which I was given a diploma with the word certified written in 28-point Seago script, outlined in genuine artificial gold leaf. I was ready for my first case, or so I thought.
This is retired dentist turned author Mike Paul reading from his newest book, The Mouth Mechanic. And you mentioned that you had to do a lot more research for your last books, but this one you were familiar with because of your own experience. But you probably, I'm sure, I know you did some research.
Like
the salary that an odontologist would get.
I did, and of course, I've really never been in a morgue myself, so I had to figure that out, well, research that a little bit.
You could have fooled me.
Oh, God.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed the references to the area of San Francisco and some of the places, like the place called the Stinking Rose came up, and I thought, who would name a restaurant the Stinking Rose? Is that really a place? It's, so I Googled it, and indeed, there is a restaurant called the Stinking Rose.
It's closed now after COVID, but it was open at the time.
Well, you reference City Lights Bookstore, and I know that exists, so I was delighted to see that. But there were other places like the Tadich Grill and Gary Danko. Oh, yeah. Wow, I had never even heard of that, but I could see it's a ritzy place. Why I never heard
those
of
are
it.
All those are all real. Yeah, I tried. I grew up in San Francisco, and I tried to make the places authentic and even the geographical places that he goes to. And so people who have lived there, worked there, visited there, they'll probably have a little connection with something in this book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I found that true for myself. Well, now, we also meet, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit more, and we meet another character in this story. And I thought, oh, I like her, because when the dentist would take the elevator down to the morgue, and she would take the stairs, and I thought, I get teased about that, because I do the same thing. If there's an elevator, I still take the stairs.
Yeah, well, you're a fitness nut. Well, the person you're talking about is Dr. Alexandra Keller, and she is the chief medical examiner for the city and county of San Francisco. So when Rick gets the job as this forensic odontologist, Dr. Alexander Keller is Alexandra Keller is his boss, and he calls her. She gives him permission. He calls her Alex. So when he refers to Alex in the book, he's really talking about this doctor who's his boss. And I guess I can mention it now. He becomes infatuated with.
Well, she is nice looking.
She's very nice looking, very nice looking.
And he's divorced, so.
He is, but some things are unattainable.
Well, that's part of the mystery. We don't want to give away what
becomes of
this.
Well, I say some things. I didn't say this thing. Okay.
Well, I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of when he goes down to the first time to the morgue.
Right. So Dr. Keller, that's Alex, hands him some very gory pictures and says to him, "You came on board at just the right time," Alex said. "Really? How so?" "Those photos are of a John Doe. He had no identification, and his prints weren't on any local, state, or federal registry. I knew he didn't check into the morgue on his own, so I asked, where did they find him?" "The day before yesterday was garbage day in North Beach, when a garbage dumpster behind the Stinking Rose restaurant was emptied at 6 a.m, John Doe came rolling out, dressed in full formal wear, a black tux, a bow tie, and a silk cummerbund."
So here, this retired dentist, you're the retired dentist, by the way, reading from your book, The Mouth Mechanic. Now, when this new forensic odontologist sees this body, and what's his reaction? Like, oh, boy, I'm glad I got this job. Was that his reaction?
No. Rick questions what he's doing here. He applied for the job because it was all he had, and he really didn't know what he was doing. Let's put it that way. And so all along the way in the entire book, Rick is trying to figure out what he's doing and how to do it. And sometimes he does it right, and sometimes he does it wrong. And when he does it wrong, he gets into a lot of trouble.
And he thinks, gosh, maybe I'm not ready for this job.
He says that to himself many times.
You know what, though? He gets involved in things where he has to lie. And I can understand how people in this situation have to lie a lot. But sometimes I think, nah, did he really need to lie about that? But this, on the other hand, this shows us he's a real guy. He's got flaws. He's not perfect.
Yeah, no, he's not. As a matter of fact, he's very imperfect, and the character is an imperfect character. He's a very self-deprecating guy. He doesn't really have any confidence in himself after what's happened to him with his marriage and his practice. But other people have confidence in him. And so he goes along always questioning his decisions, even though other people are depending on his decisions. And as you get to the end of the book, he is still questioning himself, even though he becomes successful.
Well, there was a section in your book that amused me because he goes to this restaurant and I mean, some waiters are, you know, they've got their nose in the air. And I once had a friend who, this was in Palm Beach, go to the restaurant and the waitress says, well, most people order this particular wine. And my friend said, well, maybe most people are idiots.
Yeah, that restaurant is still there. As a matter of fact, though, I just read last week they may be closing, but it's the oldest restaurant in San Francisco. I'm not going to mention their name over the air, but I did mention the real name in the book, which I don't think will get me sued. And I've been there and I've had experience. Actually, the waiters have gotten better, but in the old days, the waiters were very rude.
Well, all these things happened to him when he's only been 3 weeks on the job. And gosh, what adventures he has in just those 3 weeks. And here's a guy, you mentioned that he doesn't always make the right decisions, and he's this guy that we come to like and we want him to do well. And how did he do in dental school?
How did I do?
Well, I don't think you want to tell us how you did, but no. How did Rick Rose do in dental school?
Well, Rick Rose mentions to Alex, his boss, he asks her, why did I get the job? He said, I don't think it was because I graduated 93rd in a class of 100 at dental school.
Oh, I remembered he was 91st.
Oh, 91st? Gosh, he was smarter than I thought. Anyway,
I've read the book more recently than you wrote
it. Okay, yeah, but he's self-deprecating, and he knows what he doesn't know. And he's kind of putting himself down in front of Alex, but she ignores it and said, no, we hired you for other reasons.
Now, I mentioned that Dr. Rose has a secretary named Stella. So let's look at this conversation that starts wondering if Stella had given Alex a heads up.
Well, the heads up is that Rick's life has been threatened, and he's really giving serious thought about this. So he walks in and he says, I'm not sure if Stella had given Alex a heads up or if Alex just happened to be in the vicinity, but an hour later she knocked on my door. I recognized the soft tap, and although I dreamt of having a long conversation with Alex, this wasn't a good time. I raised my voice so I could be heard through the door and said, I'm out of the office at this time. Check back later. The door opened and Alex stepped in.
Rick, what's wrong?
I'm thinking of quitting.
What? What? You're doing such a good job.
I'm beginning to think a long life beats 136,400 a year.
I don't understand. What does one have to do with the other?
I've had a death threat.
Huh? What? What kind of death threat?
Well, I think there's only one kind. Do what I say or I'll kill you. Alex sat down on my spare chair and took a deep breath.
Who did this come from?
A couple messengers with big muscles.
Messengers for who?
I don't know, but he wants those John Doe's crown.
Or they'll kill you?
That's the way I interpreted the message.
I'm confused. How would they even know about the crown?
I shrugged. I have no idea. But just so you know, another body related to John Doe checked into the morgue yesterday.
Why do you think they're related?
I really didn't want to talk about teeth right now, and I didn't think that this was the right time to lay out my underpants theory to the boss. So I said, it's complicated, but take my word for it. They're related.
My guest is retired dentist Mike Paul, and he draws on his experience as a dentist to write a Rick Rose novel, and the title is The Mouth Mechanic. And so this guy kind of gets swept along in this adventure that he didn't want to be a part of, and it was scary. And when I'm reading your book, I turn a page and, I didn't expect that. So there are a lot of surprises in your book that if I'm a typical reader, which I don't know that I am, but things that I didn't see coming.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and it kept me turning the pages.
Well, that's good, too.
So you have us laughing and crying and all through this adventure with this this guy, and you say this is a Rick Rose novel. So if you're saying that, I'm thinking, oh, maybe this is just the first in a series.
Matter of fact, I'll tell you, for the you're the first one to know, I've started the second in the series. Obviously, some of the characters come back, the major characters. Some of the characters don't. And the forensic part of it is different. I'm not going to give away the forensics of this one next one. But it still has to do with dentistry and the head and the mouth. But it's a whole different issue. And the mystery, of course, is totally brand new. And the villains are all brand new.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you about this book. And I think readers will really, particularly if they enjoy mysteries, they'll enjoy this book. The title again is The Mouth Mechanic. It's a Rick Rose novel, and the author is retired dentist Mike Paul. Thank you, Dr. Paul.
You're welcome.
My guest has been retired dentist Mike Paul, whose book is The Mouth Mechanic. After a short break, I'll be talking to local author Steve Metzger about his new book, Between Rock and Hard Places. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest has worked as a freelance writer since the early 1980s, has written travel books, and is co-author of a popular college textbook, The Writer's Way. Steve Metzger has written for local, national, and international publications, including the Chico News and Review. From 1982 to 2010, he taught writing, literature, and journalism at Chico State University and composition at Butte College from 2010 to 2018. Today, I'm going to ask Steve Metzger about his Mike McMahon mystery, Between Rock and Hard Places. Steve Metzger, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, this book it takes place in the Bay Area, so right. It made me wonder, you must have lived there.
Yeah, it's my old stomping grounds. It's Marin County, Mill Valley.
That's what I thought, because it seemed so real as you were writing about it. And you introduce us to a lot of characters that I begin wondering, okay, this main character, I know he's got there's overlap between you and this main character. For example, He probably, I mean, you like sports, I would imagine.
Right.
Your character likes sports.
And he's a Giants fan.
You had to get that in.
Well, we're recording this 2 days after Willie Mays died. So yeah. I've been thinking about that.
So your main character, Mike McMahon, is a sports fan. Now, he likes rock and roll music. In fact, that's in the title, Rock and Hard Places. So I'm guessing you like rock and roll music.
Well, that's the pun, yeah.
And then he likes puns. And if you taught writing, I'm sure you like wordplay.
Yeah, he likes puns, and he's also a smartass.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question about one of my favorite characters in your book. And he has four legs.
Oh, Luther.
Luther. Yeah. I happen to be a dog lover. And I know you have a dog, Rosie, at home.
I do.
So I was thinking, okay, well, you had a model right there in your own home for one of your characters.
Sort of, yeah. I've had dogs all my life, but Luther's kind of a special dog, and I don't want to give too much away, but he has a part in the solution of the murder.
He does, and I don't want to give that away either. Okay, so you actually taught like this character in your book, Mike McMahon. And he's also a musician.
Right.
You played an instrument also, I'm guessing.
I play guitar, yeah.
Oh, good.
And I'm a huge fan of the history of rock and roll. And so
he
moonlights as he teaches at the College of Marin. He teaches a class in the history of rock and roll. So I'm trying to tie that all together.
Now, that was one thing I thought he does. Your character teaches this course in rock and roll, but... did you ever have an opportunity to teach rock and roll as a college course?
I snuck it into my classes.
I see. Unofficial. Well, let's meet this character. Let's start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start.
That sounds familiar.
I thought you'd get it.
Okay, this is from Between Rock and Hard Places. Jim Rooney's maroon 1965 Mustang convertible sailed off Highway 1 just north of San Francisco a little after 10 one morning last February, crashing 20 feet below into boulders and foamy Pacific whitewater. According to the Independent Journal, the local newspaper, and a brief obit in Rolling Stone, he'd gone into cardiac arrest and lost consciousness and probably didn't even know he'd left the road. His widow wasn't so sure. She thought he might have been murdered. She'd been waiting for me when I got out of class. I'm a private investigator, but to make ends meet, I teach a course at Marin Community College in the history of rock and roll. A lot of the kids who sign up think they're going to get to listen to Led Zeppelin and watch YouTube clips for homework, and then drop the second week when I assign Rimbo, Ginsberg, and Frederick Douglass and tell them that we'll be studying Brown versus Board of Education and that anyone who calls Jim Morrison a poet automatically fails. Not that I don't take full advantage of the miracle of YouTube.
Mr. McMahon.
She looked too old to be a student and too alert to be an administrator.
My name is Sarah Rooney. My husband played with the Johnny Sands Band.
I stopped short, although I'd have been glad for any distraction. Shelley Martin had followed me out of class, wanting me to read a draft of her paper on women's music of the 60s and 70s. Why don't you work a bit on narrowing your topic, I said. We'll take a look at it next week. She nodded, and Mrs. Rooney and I watched her walk away.
I'm sorry. I know you're a very busy man, but I need your help. Can I buy you a cup of coffee or something else?
A glass of something else sounded really, really good. I looked at my watch.
Stronger?
You know the Al Cafe, I said?
Sure.
I'll meet you there in 15 minutes.
So this is Stephen Metzger reading his Mike McMahon mystery, Between Rock and Hard Places. So this is when we meet Jim Rooney. We don't meet Jim Rooney. This is about Jim Rooney. And the story's being told in the first person. So we immediately, gosh, this is a real guy talking to us and telling us this story.
I tried to make him sound real.
So this woman is waiting for you outside your class. And
him, not me. Mike McMahon.
Well, I'm not Sarah Rooney either, but I'm reading her words. Okay, so why don't we pick up there she's sitting at a stool.
Okay. Mrs. Rooney was already sitting at a stool at the bar when I walked in, her denim skirt hiked up, one leg crossed narrowly over the other. Though her hair was streaked with gray and her face lined and leathered, she was still a very attractive woman, 60, 65, I figured. She wore a loose-fitting embroidered tank top tucked into her skirt, Birkenstock sandals and turquoise earrings, which accented her pale blue eyes. The skin in her upper chest was pale and smooth, lightly mottled. She wore several rings on each hand. I sat down beside her, and she turned to me. She had a glass of something else on the rocks in front of her. Impressive.
Thanks for coming.
I nodded at the woman tending bar who poured a Jameson's over and set it in front of me. I was sorry to hear about Jim, I said. I'm a huge fan. Wish I'd been around in the old days. She took a sip. She took a deep breath and sipped at her drink. Sorry, I said. That's probably the last thing you want to talk about. She looked up, shook her head.
No, that's exactly what I want to talk about.
I took a sip of my whiskey and waited for her to continue.
You saw the papers. Jimmy goes into cardiac arrest. His car goes off the road. He dies. Pretty straightforward, right?
I guess.
Well, it wasn't like that. I mean, obviously, his car did go off the road, and obviously he did die, but I'm convinced he...
I looked up suddenly. She shook her head slowly.
The thing is, Jimmy had had some heart issues, AFib about 5 years ago, but he'd been treated and was on meds and doing fine, perfect health. So you have this... Steve Metzger now. You're writing this conversation about this woman who was married to somebody whose car goes off the road, and they said, oh, well, he just had a heart attack. And so your character is wondering, well, so why do you need to see me? So why don't we continue there?
Okay. But Mrs. Rooney, a lot of guys seem to be in perfect health, and then I didn't know how to end the sentence I'd started.
I know. And if the circumstances were different, I'd say, fine, he went into cardiac arrest, whatever, naturally, and I'd be good with that. Naturally.
I looked at her skeptically. You don't think his death was natural? She shook her head deliberately. You think he was murdered? She took a long breath, bit her lower lip, then nodded. I'm sorry, Mrs.
Sarah.
Sarah, I'm sorry, but I don't quite follow. Wasn't there a coroner's report?
Sure, and that's where the cardiac arrest stuff came from. But it was pure speculation.
I'm not sure I follow you. She took a deep breath.
I regret it now, but I didn't have them do an autopsy.
So they just assumed it was cardiac arrest, and that's what caused the crash?
Well, it would be a natural assumption. He'd been treated for the heart condition and everything. In fact, that's how his father died. So... if you didn't have any reason not to, you'd just say cardiac arrest.
You have a reason not to? She nodded, held up her empty glass to the bartender.
Look, Jimmy was writing a book. In fact, he'd finished the book.
A book? I have a knack for the brilliant response.
The bartender replaced her glass.
Poured another couple of shots of Jameson over the rocks. I drained mine and held the empty glass up for a refill.
Great minds. Thank you.
She forced a smile and turned back to me.
About his days with Johnny Sands and the band, about the early days, everything, in fact, the plane crash afterwards.
Not to doubt your word, Mrs. Sarah, but who would want to kill him to keep him from writing a book?
That's what I need you for.
I sipped my whiskey. Let's back up for a second. You don't have anything concrete that he was murdered. What do you have that makes you think his death was connected to what he was writing?
It's what I don't have.
What don't you have?
The book.
You don't have the book? Another impressive bon mot.
The morning he died, he was on his way to the post office to mail the backup hard copy to his publisher. He'd gotten up early, written his acknowledgments, and then he woke me up and took me to breakfast. Afterward, he dropped me off at home, put the manuscript in a box, and headed out. I live out by Point Reyes Station, and he has said he had some other errands to run in San Rafael. He said he was going to email the final files when he got home that afternoon. I'd never seen him so happy as when he pulled out of the driveway. Of course, with his Mustang's top down, he waved the box with the manuscript in it, blew me a kiss. And that was the last time I saw him alive. So we have this conversation, and she's telling you, Sarah Rooney, the wife of the deceased, is telling Mike McMahon why she needs his help.
Because he's written this book about the band's early days and apparently something, and we get it, there's something about a plane crash, we hear. So
yeah.
That would have been included in the book, and the book has disappeared.
So then your character says that he still doesn't get it. After a break, I'll be back with my guest, Steve Metzger, whose book is Between Rock and Hard Places. It's a Mike McMahon mystery. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, freelance writer Steve Metzger, whose novel is Between Rock and Hard Places. Steve Metzger has been a freelance writer for a long time, since the early 80s, and his newest book is Between Rock and Hard Places, and it's taking place in the Bay Area. So we are getting to know this woman whose husband has died under what nobody thinks is unusual circumstances, but she does think there was something about it. So now there's another character in here named Rebecca Rosenberg. And who is she?
Rebecca Rosenberg. I just read this again last night. And who is Rebecca Rosenberg?
Becca.
Oh, Becca.
Becca.
Becca, of course. His girlfriend. She teaches Anglo-Saxon Lit at San Francisco State. And he always calls her Becca.
That's, yes.
Sorry about that. They've had this on-again, off-again relationship, and it's kind of off-again right now, but he regrets that, and he realizes he's not a very good boyfriend, but he's also caught up in this case, too, and can't give over all his time to her, and she's not sure she wants him to, and so there's a bit about the relationship and some background on the relationship, how they got to where they are now.
Now, Becca, as you know her, Becca, you mentioned, teaches English. She teaches at San Francisco State. And I really enjoyed the puns because you put an English professor and you taught writing yourself, the real Steve Metzger taught writing. And so the puns, I just really enjoyed the puns that come up in your book. Now, her father, because you have to see him in writing, I wanted to read it like...
Well, he does have a sports car named Portia, who's a Shakespeare character, right?
Okay. That would be one.
And she suggested the name, and he didn't understand it. She had to explain it to him.
Okay. I can ask him about that pun. Now, you and your character, Mike, and Becca, exchange puns. Can you give an example?
Oh, boy. Yeah, at one point, they're talking about whether women can actually be murderers. He's saying, no, it had to be it could be a woman, maybe it's a man, but it had to be a woman. And she goes, no, women aren't murderers. And he goes, well, what about Attila the Hunny? And...
Well, you know what, and Caligula.
Oh, Caligula.
Caligula.
Right.
But that conversation started because he used improper grammar.
Right.
He said, well, if someone murdered him, we've got to find out
That's
about
right.
them.
Yeah. Right.
And she says, hey, wait a minute. Someone and them.
Right.
And this is something that drives me crazy, too. But English is just, we have no solution really right now. The English language just doesn't have a singular
right.
for
right.
that. So I thought, yeah, right on, Becca. And then that leads into the puns that you just gave examples of. Now, your character has a car, and that's a pun.
Right.
What kind of car does he have?
Well, it's a Cabriolet 1956 bathtub Porsche. And
which I could say Porsche.
Porsche. That's what, and I would too, and that's why I said Porsche. But she suggests that he name it Porsche, which character Shakespeare's P-O-R-T-I-A, which he names it, but he didn't understand. He doesn't understand the joke, so she has to explain it to him.
Well, now, I would encourage people who like puns to read your book because then they can see these puns written. It's much easier to get them when they're written out.
Well,
see.
It's funny you should say that because it's a serious story. There's at least one murder. I don't want to give it away, but there's at least one murder. And it's dark in some places, but I hope it's funny in other words. I really had fun writing it.
Do you know, I'd like you to read a paragraph that I thought was funny. And this is when your character is saying, well, you know, I need to kind of make up with Becca. And so what I need to do is get her a gift. And, oh, gosh, what am I going to do about that? So would you read that couple paragraphs there?
I'm going to start above where we had it marked. On my way home, I stopped at Nordstrom's to look for something for Becca. I needed some kind of peace offering. What did she need? Oops. Gift foul. Women get pouty when you buy them what they need. Give me a gift I can use. New guitar strings, a garden hose, drill bits, a socket set, a six-pack, a leaf blower, even a bag of treats for Luther, who's the dog.
The dog.
But I've learned no useful stuff at all. Bath mats, shower curtains, microwaves, bread knives, salad spinners. Wonderful gifts by my reckoning, not by hers. Although candlesticks have worked in a pinch. A sexy nightgown? Nope.
This is a gift for you, Michael.
Not when things are going this badly. A book, nah, she'd take it wrong, no matter what it was.
And you're trying to tell me by this, what are you trying to tell me, Michael?
Honey, it's just a book. I'm not trying to tell you anything at all.
Yeah, right. Pride and prejudice. Now I'm too proud?
No, not at all.
Prejudiced?
Finally, I left and stopped at Kiko's, bought her a gift certificate for a massage and had it sent anonymously. When I got home, I made two more lists of all the people I could think of who were connected to Jim Rohn.
So that was the section that you're talking about. Gosh, how do you get a gift for your girlfriend? And because it's easy to get a gift for a guy, right? So then you get home and you're trying to figure out this supposed things that other people said, well, that wasn't a murder. But you've been hired, your character Mike, is hired as a private investigator. So we as readers suspect, things
well,
must not have been
what
they
appear.
Well, and
then weird things start happening. Other people from the old days in the band start getting mysterious visits.
Well, now, since you mentioned the band, the name of the band was Johnny Sands Band.
Right.
And I'm assuming that's fictional because you mentioned other people that are real.
Right. Well, yeah, Johnny Sands is sort of actually when I first wrote the book, I imagined him as a Buddy Holly character from the 50s. But
in fact, I wondered if that's what gave you the idea for writing this book because I remember Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper, Ritchie Valens, these rock stars died in plane crashes.
The same plane crash.
Yeah.
Right.
Same
plane it's funny you should say that because. Well, you talked about my being a travel writer. I spent tons of time in New Mexico, wrote 6 editions of a New Mexico guidebook, which you interviewed me and mm-hmm. Kim Weir about. But I was down there one time in Clovis, which is where Buddy Holly recorded. They drive over from Lubbock and record in Clovis. And I got to thinking one afternoon as I was driving, his wife Maria was pregnant when his plane went down, and then she miscarried shortly after. And so I got to thinking, what if Buddy Holly had a kid? And that was sort of the germ for the whole book. And then I worked on it so long, I had to bump it up. It takes the band was recording in the 70s instead of the 50s. So, but that was the germ of the book.
In fact, there's one place where you're talking to Becca. Your character is talking to Becca. And he mentions some rock star that she said, I don't remember. That was way before my time.
Right.
And
she's
your character
a little younger
said,
than he is.
When you write that, I see that. And then your character says, if I'd mentioned Justin Timberlake, you would have recognized that name. But
especially
this is
today
before,
with that in the news.
So you mentioned real characters. And now your character has a student named Chet Porter who comes up after class. And he has this idea of something he wants to write. He wants to change what he was going to write about. And your character gives him advice in the note that he wrote, because instead of spelling out the word, "I'd like to see you, Professor," instead of spelling it out, "Y-O-U," he writes "you." So I'm guessing that's something maybe that irritated you when you were teaching.
I saw it a lot in my students. It didn't irritate me. I was just trying to make it real.
And then also the use of commas.
Well, it's just another joke, me having fun.
Yeah, because you put a lot of commas in the sentence that weren't needed. Yeah.
Exactly.
Another thing that I thought must kind of get under your skin is when one of the characters is talking about Frisco instead of saying San Francisco.
Yeah, again, me interjecting some of my own pet peeves there.
That's what I thought, because I know there are people that find that pet peeve worthy. Another section that I enjoyed when Sarah and your character go out to dinner, and this waiter named Antoine.
Oh, Antoine.
Because I've encountered waiters like that.
What page is Antoine on there?
Antoine's on page 19. Yeah.
Okay. Around 5, I shower-dressed and headed down to the grotto where the maitre d' asked if I was Mr. McMahon, then showed me to a table where Sarah was waiting.
Thanks for coming.
So Antoine's the waiter, and he's having dinner with Sarah, trying to decide whether he wants to take the case or not. Antoine appeared, looking as if he were doing us a favor. I asked him to tell me again about the sturgeon, then ordered the swordfish. Sarah ordered the scampi. "Very well," he said, and returned to the kitchen. "Oh, and I'd like another beer," I said after him. He stopped without turning, took a visible breath, then continued walking away.
Now, I might mention that beer is a local beer producer right here in Chico.
That's right. He likes Sierra Nevada, but he also likes beer from the Marin Brewing Company.
Yeah, but I thought that was nice. You got in a word for our local Sierra Nevada.
Right.
Okay, so then continue.
Yeah, I looked at Sarah Rooney. "I know I asked you not to call me until Wednesday, but I should tell you I'm very interested in this case. I was a big fan of the Johnny Sands Band and of your husband's. I've got most of those jazz albums he did in the 80s. Sarah smiled and took a sip of her drink.
That's how he ended up here. Followed Lester Corbin out to L.A., and they worked in the studios together for a while. He made those jazz records on the side. That's when we met. I was doing freelance graphic design, and he needed an album cover.
Sounds like a fairy tale.
Kind of was. We went out for 6 months and then drove to Reno and got married. He kept playing music and I kept drawing pictures. Finally, we couldn't take L.A. anymore, retired, and moved up here to Marin 5 years ago.
Kids?" She shook her head.
"Just the two of us."
"I'll need $1,000 up front," I said. "That plus expenses will cover 2 weeks. After that, we'll see where we stand."
"Oh, Mike, I can't thank you enough."
"Don't thank me yet. Antoine showed up with our orders. I told him I'd changed my mind and wanted the sturgeon after all."
And this is Steve Metzger reading from his book, Between Rock and Hard Places, which is a Mike McMahon mystery. And I mentioned that I think people will enjoy your book on a lot of levels, Steve.
I hope so.
And since this is a Mike McMahon mystery, I'm guessing maybe there's more to come.
Yeah, I'm well into the second one. It's another murder. He's got a new Newfoundland puppy.
Yeah, and we will look forward to that. Thank you again, Steve.
Thank you.
Again, my guest has been Steve Metzger. His book is Between Rock and Hard Places, a Mike McMahon mystery. I would also like to thank my first guest, Mike Paul, whose novel is The Mouth Mechanic. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
A visit to Pam's closet. I thought I'd take a quick little stroll. Was watching TV, but I could pause it. It was going to be just a short little break. Found myself in our bedroom closet. I looked around at shirts of mine and remembered days of play. And there were some that were well-worn for sure, and those splattered from painting day. I gazed upon well-creased slacks, mostly new and hardly worn. For now, it's just Levi's and shorts, and like me, wrinkled and torn. Then I happened to gaze upon a shelf I never use, and saw two rows of clear plastic boxes, all labeled with names of shoes. "Holy smoke," I thought. I said aloud, How could there be so many? I know my Pammy has but 2 feet. Shoes? I've hardly any. I could not help but notice all the names and specifics about the shoes, starting with Adidas Trekkers, ending with Nike Blues. Now bear with me, and I'll take you upon a tour of all those shoes. Notice how they come up with names. Green Plush Puppies, Miami Blues. Daily I see in the paper a sale and a promise of such great deals. I saw some leopard flats brand new, next to black suede heels. Shoes for running, shoes for walking, shoes for trimming hedges. Most of them had shiny new soles, except the well-worn brown-heeled wedges. I stood there slack-jawed with keen surprise. Some were financial steals, like maybe those black-studded ankle boots, or perhaps those strappy heels. Pink kids, Teva Mauve, and winter hiking boots. And I have but a single pair for dress to go with in frequent suits. Brown suede platform heels, maybe worn for work. But can someone please explain to me, what's Coco Ventura Cork? White strappy heels, white summer heels, black buckled half boots too. And those Joseph Seibel hiking boots, I swear they look brand new. Casual flats, patent leather flats, black flats with pointy toes, all lined up so neatly, creating 2 exquisite rows. Flip-flop flaps with 2-inch heels and a couple pair of Crocs, right there for her running days, for jogging or short walks. Flip-flop brown, flip-flop black, ankle boots abound, rain boots, grain boots, far in the back, but they were also found. Wear me, use me, I think I heard them yell. And then I saw the silver flats, spongified with gel. Flats of brown, flats of green, the tags say some were beaded. And I could tell from just one look, they were waterproofed and treated. Black high heels, ah, a familiar name. I no longer felt a fool. But then I got confused again when I saw the brown suede mules. Brown slides, black slides, and bandoleros for the spring. And then I noticed striped flip-flops, a most clumsy-looking thing. The TV's pause, time was up. It called on me to see. I should mention something to Pam, I thought, and wonder where she'd be. I finally realized they don't eat food or take up that much room. She's not home right now, I remembered. Shoe shopping, I presume. Mark Malinger.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.